This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk to a lawyer about her work to keep the federal government from foreclosing on family farms during the 1980s farm crisis and the lessons that case has for farmers today. First, the Republican-backed investigation of the 2020 election in Wisconsin continues. Now, one of the local officials being deposed is making accusations against the person running the investigation. Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich is accusing former State Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman of making false statements, and Genrich's legal team is asking for a court to penalize Gableman for it. We're getting the latest on the lawsuits, counter-lawsuits, and the investigation itself. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the idea of this investigation expanding its scope? Do you want to see it continue, or do you think it's gone on long enough? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Laurel White is WPR State Capitol reporter and co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
A lot going on related to this investigation. Let's start with the most recent story, the one I just mentioned. The mayor of Green Bay, his lawyer accusing Gableman of false statements. What's going on?
So basically what's going on there is a disagreement over Genrich's level of cooperation with the election investigation. So Gableman subpoenaed actually the mayors of the state's five largest cities in October to provide information to investigators about how election administration went in their communities in 2020. Genrich was one of those mayors, of course, and there has been kind of confusion and back and forth since then about the power of the subpoenas. There have been lawsuits about the subpoenas, whether they're enforceable, the scope of the subpoenas, what needs to be provided in terms of documentation and in-person testimony. And what Gableman has said, both in legal filings and in some public comments, is that Genrich has refused basically to cooperate and provide in-person testimony. And Genrich's lawyers have pushed back now in this official capacity and said that's not true, that Gableman and Genrich's lawyers, the city of Green Bay has actually retained outside counsel for this case, had come to an agreement about postponing in-person testimony after documentation was reviewed, after the city turned over about 20,000 or more than 20,000 pages of election-related documents. And so they want Gableman to essentially publicly apologize for saying that Genrich hasn't cooperated by providing that in-person testimony yet. They want him to take out full-page ads in newspapers across the state saying that he made false statements, do things like undergo 3 hours of ethics training. So a pretty strong, pushback from Genrich's lawyers here saying, hey, Gableman has really misrepresented how this relationship has played out over the past few months.
And has the former Supreme Court Justice Gableman or his team, have they responded to this?
They haven't. I reached out for comment yesterday, and we haven't heard back from them on that. But it has certainly been a drumbeat from Gableman for the past several weeks at least, that there hasn't been the level of cooperation that he's wanted from specific officials across the state for his investigation. And that has prolonged the investigation. The investigation has gone past a couple different sort of understood deadlines. We first thought it was going to be done in the fall of last year. And he said that's partially because folks haven't, given him what he's asked for up until this point.
Let's talk about that, the wider sort of timeline of this investigation. As you said, it went past the initial goal deadline. We're hearing from Assembly Speaker Voss, who in effect convened this investigation. What's the latest talk about when this thing could wrap up?
So this is really evolving and complicated. We actually got a little bit of new information today. WisPolitics reported that Speaker Voss is saying that he wants the investigation to be wrapped up by the end of this month, by February, or the end of February. He said wrapped up by February. So I suppose that could be the end of February as well. And that's an interesting kind of development because, as I mentioned, you know, the first understood deadline was the fall. Then Voss said the end of 2021. And now he's saying that this agreement, which he says isn't on paper, it's just a spoken agreement between himself and former Justice Gableman, is for, you know, essentially, you know, less than 2 months from now. And some of the new developments in terms of legal filings in this investigation include subpoenas that went out not long ago over the holidays between Christmas and New Year's that actually have dates for in-person testimony in mid-February. So if Gableman were to meet this new deadline that the speaker has mentioned, it would be a very, very quick turnaround from when this scheduled subpoenaed testimony would take place in mid-February to him wrapping up the investigation and issuing his recommendations.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics podcast, looking at the ongoing Gableman investigation, looking back at the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions about all the angles here going on. I will go to a caller now. Nick is with us in Green Bay. Nick, hi.
Hi. I'm a little jaded, so hopefully this doesn't offend anybody, but I think all politicians are like criminals. And, you know, if you got nothing to hide, why aren't you a little more forthcoming? That's, you know, I mean, I love my country. I just fear my government. That's all, you know.
Nick, thanks for the call. And, Laurel, that's been an argument from Gableman and I think Assembly Speaker Voss at some point. You know, why not cooperate if everything is hunky-dory? Is that something we've heard from the leaders of this investigation?
Absolutely, 100%. They have said just that. If there's nothing to hide, why don't you come forward and provide testimony? And the pushback from folks has been that kind of there are multiple parts of it. So I would say one of the primary arguments from these mayors, and Genrich has been a focus, as has Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway, saying that they want testimony to be conducted in a certain way and agreed upon, particularly done in public. They don't want their testimony to be provided behind closed doors. They think it's something that the public should be able to witness, sort of what the questions are, what their answers are, because it's a taxpayer-funded investigation. They think that that's appropriate. Gableman wants these in-person interviews to be done behind closed doors because he says kind of having it out in public would give folks a heads up about what the questions are, people kind of later in line, right? He says that would compromise the integrity of the investigation. So that's one big element of pushback, kind of the public versus private element of these interviews. But there are several other things that are actually pending in a lawsuit about the enforceability of the subpoenas. And that lawsuit was brought by State Attorney General Josh Call, who's representing the Wisconsin Elections Commission, which has been subpoenaed in the case. And he says that the subpoenas aren't enforceable for a number of other reasons, including the investigation kind of going beyond its appropriate scope, becoming sort of a criminal enterprise, a law enforcement enterprise, not a legislative one. The fact that the scope of the subpoenas is so broad that they're inappropriate. It also makes some due process arguments. And really, you know, you mentioned that there have been so many developments in this story, right? We're actually waiting on a decision in that case that's expected to come either tomorrow or Monday. So we're going to get a lot of additional kind of information about how this is going to move forward within the next few days.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Speaking of new developments this week, news about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, a separate court case. This was yesterday, I think. This was a suit now challenging Voss for not, as I understand it, Laurel, revealing some documents related to the investigation. What's the background on that?
So the background on that is there's a liberal group called American Oversight that has been for several months trying to get Speaker Voss to release documents about the election investigation. They want him to release contracts, communications between himself and Gableman, basically just information about kind of the structure of the investigation, the expectations, staffing, things like that. They argue that that's appropriate under public record. because this is a taxpayer-funded effort. And Voss has been very resistant to that and has sort of echoed the sentiments of Gableman that I mentioned earlier about compromising the integrity of the investigation by making certain things public, giving folks a heads up ahead of time so they can be in sort of a defensive posture before they are asked to provide information. And so about election administration.
And so the new development here is a judge says, yeah, you're going to need to tell us something, right?
Right. So basically the new order is a judge saying, Speaker Voss, you need to sit for a deposition and explain why you haven't released some documents or what your decision-making process has been or your process for going about fulfilling records requests. Essentially, she said she's trying to make sure that there aren't documents in existence that he hasn't been putting forward, because the group that's asked for them said that the record fulfillments that they've gotten haven't been sufficient.
We're talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. She's with us today with the latest, and there's a lot of latest, on the Republican-backed investigation of the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see those communications about the Republican-backed investigation be made public? What do you think of the idea from some Republicans to get rid of the Wisconsin Elections Commission? What questions do you have about all the twists and turns in this investigation? Do you think it should still be going on, or do you think there's been enough between the courts and other investigations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk about Republican efforts to investigate the 2020 presidential election in Wisconsin. WPR's Laurel White stays with us, and you can join in with your questions, your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now with Sarah in Eau Claire. Sarah, hi.
Hi. I guess I was...
Are you still there, Sarah? Oh, I guess she is not. Let's see. Our producer says Sarah was hoping that whatever comes out of this has some teeth, that this isn't just, a formal investigation without consequences. And Laurel, what is the stated goal of this investigation? Is it the idea that there will be flaws found in the 2020 election, or like the Legislative Audit Bureau's audit, ways to improve Wisconsin's election in the future? What is the final product supposed to be as far as we know?
I think the understanding right now, based on comments from leaders, is that there are going to be recommendations from former Justice Gableman for changes to Wisconsin election laws based on his review. So, like you said, kind of similar to the audit that we received from the Legislative Audit Bureau late last year, which made dozens of recommendations for changes to Elections Commission policies and state laws. It would be a kind of, here's a roadmap moving forward, at least in Gableman's opinion, of ways to make elections more secure, to ensure more public faith and kind of the process.
Let's go now to Russ in Belleville. Russ, hello.
Hey, Al. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Russ?
Well, I'm really tired of the Republicans wasting our money on this witch hunt. I mean, the only reason my boss started this is because Trump pitched a fit with him, and like most of the other Republicans, they're afraid of Trump. So, look at Trump lost by 20,000 votes. Hillary Clinton lost by the same number of votes. And if she had pitched a fit like this, the Republicans have been all over calling her a sore loser. So it's just a problem in search of us, or not it's a solution in search of a problem. And they're just making it so that people don't trust the election anymore, because they're the ones who are making all these false claims that have been shot down in every court and every review.
Russ, thanks for the call. Is there a sense, Laurel, among some that Republicans might be looking over their shoulders at former President Trump and doing this kind of investigation with him in mind?
Well, that is definitely something that's been part of the conversation. And we know that Speaker Voss has acknowledged that he has been in touch with former President Trump throughout this investigation. He said, it's not frequent, but that he has spoken with the former president several times to just kind of keep him apprised of what's going on. So there's certainly no indication that the former president isn't weighing on the mind of Speaker Voss as this process unfolds, and that he's had kind of an influence on it.
Thanks for that call, Russ. We'll go to Terry next in Green Bay. Terry, hello.
Yeah. Hey, I just wanted to mention that, you know, I think our mayor is just terrible. I mean, what he did in the 2020 election, as far as getting involvement from taking the money from Mark Zuckerberg and actually implementing and taking away the register of deeds to, you know, violating her position and putting someone in there involved is just terrible. I mean, the guy should be run out of town. And tell you what, he's just going to be a one-time mayor. This guy is, and he should be facing Gableman. If you're not scared, just go ahead and do it.
Terry, thanks a lot for the call. Terry pointing toward some of what former Justice Gableman is talking about, a nonprofit funded in large part by Mark Zuckerberg, providing assistance to communities, including Green Bay, leading up to that election.
Right. That's a big part of Gableman's investigation, are these grants from the Center for Tech and Civic Life, which was founded and funded by Mark Zuckerberg and his wife. And Republicans have pushed back and said that those grants, particularly in the five largest cities in Wisconsin, which got the lion's share of the money, money did go to a number of other communities in Wisconsin from the organization to help with election administration, but the biggest cities got the biggest chunks of money. They say that that enabled undue influence by this outside group. And there's been a lot of pushback to that from the other side, saying that communities needed this support and that reviews have found that the outside, individuals that were involved didn't do anything to skew election results or compromise the process.
Thanks for the call, Terry. Nate joins us next in Northeast Wisconsin. Nate, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to ask about, Nate?
I have a question about the type of investigation that former Justice Gableman is engaged in. I'm wondering if this sort of investigation has any precedence in Wisconsin history, and if so, have those earlier investigations have any limitations set on them in terms of scope or length?
Oh, interesting, Nate. Have we seen things like this before, Laurel?
That's a really interesting question, and one that I can't answer with 100% certainty. I know that I am not aware of anything like this, at least in the recent history of Wisconsin. I think, having a legislative body approve an investigation like this is something that is written into state law as possible. So, and there are structures for it. So it's not something that has just been brought up or, created for this process. But I'm not aware of anything recent that we can point to and say, hey, these were the parameters that were followed for another investigation. And those are, potentially need to be applied here.
Nate, thanks for calling. Jeff joins us next in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, thank you for this opportunity. I have a lot of opinions on various levels of this topic, not only nationally, but certainly in Wisconsin. I'm a resident of Superior and in Douglas County. I had a conversation with our county clerk regarding counting the ballots in the last election, and one of her concerns was, and she's actually a Democrat, was concerned that the military votes come by PDF file. So those military votes could have been switched. Those things need to be investigated. I'm glad that Speaker Voss is authorizing this investigation. There's other rumors of rest home residents not voting or voting twice, things like that. Those things need to be investigated. And I personally believe, right or wrong, that Wisconsin's electors chosen for the Electoral College were not legitimate because of the absentee ballots in Wisconsin.
Jeff, thanks for the call. We had the Legislative Audit Bureau audit, Laurel, and they didn't find fraud or mistaken ballots at anything like the five-digit number range, right?
Right. So we have had, as you mentioned, that Legislative Audit Bureau audit, which was a statewide audit. We've had several audits conducted by the State Elections Commission that are routine after every election. We had a presidential recount in both Dane and Milwaukee counties that were conducted and found very few vote changes. And we also had, as folks I'm sure recall, several lawsuits after the 2020 election And none of those were successful in court in proving any sort of widespread fraud or wrongdoing. And that's a big pushback on this investigation, is that there have already been so many inquiries to see if there had been things that would have changed the outcome of the election. And they just haven't been uncovered to this point.
Thanks for the call. Laurel, I just want to take our last minute and a half or so for another big angle. Some calls to get rid of the Wisconsin Elections Commission coming from some, but not all, Republicans. Can you give us the Cliff's Notes version of that?
So that kind of comes from the Legislative Audit Bureau audit of election administration in 2020. A lot of Republicans were concerned about Elections Commission policy changes that were recommended in that audit. They said that the number of recommended changes reflected poorly on how the Elections Commission has handled Wisconsin elections. And so they have said its administrator needs to step down. There need to be conversations about replacing it potentially. But that's something that we learned this week doesn't have the support from a very important person in Wisconsin politics, which is the Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemahieu. If something like that was going to move forward from the legislature and even, you know, begin the path to the governor's desk, it would need support from someone like him. So it doesn't look like that kind of change is on the table, at least for now.
Laurel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That's Laurel White, WPR's state capitol reporter, co-host of the WPR Politics Podcast. She is with us today to catch us up on a lot of the latest on investigations into the 2020 election still going on here in Wisconsin. You can find her reporting at WPR.org while you're there. You can, of course, check out the WPR Politics Podcast. Great way to stay on top of the latest going on here in the state. And follow us on Facebook. The Ideas Network Facebook page will keep you up to date as well. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, many Americans worked at home at some point in the last couple of years, for better or worse. And that gives us a chance to rethink the workplace, to make us happier and more productive. It's according to the authors of the new book, Out of Office. You can hear the story and maybe weigh in with your own experience. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on The Ideas Network. Are you still looking for a 2022 New Year's resolution? How about some help for the world of artificial intelligence research? Janelle Shane of the website AI Weirdness has been a guest on the show. She fed some prompts to machine learning algorithms to get some unique ideas to kick off the new year. Some were standard and or boring, but here are a few of the more interesting ones she shared following her prompt for unique resolutions. Here we go. Record every adjective I hear on the radio. Act like a cabbage for a month. At 4 o'clock every day, I will climb a tree. Speak only to apples for 24 hours. Dress in a way that only a ghost could love. Find Old Man Winter, hug him, and let him know everything will be okay. Here's a resolution. Under every rock I come across for a month, I'll write all power to the rocks. Or put on a red shirt and scream, I'm not wearing pants, every time I leave the house. Give them a try. Let us know how they turn out. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, a new poll shows most young Americans think our democracy is in trouble or failing. As the country marks the first anniversary of the January 6th insurrection, you'll get a look ahead to the future and hear from America's youngest voters. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, family farmers have faced tough times in recent years, and that's not the first time. The 1980s farm crisis brought rising costs for farmers along with severe weather that damaged crops. And a federal agency designed to assist farmers was threatening many of them with foreclosure and the prospect of losing their farms altogether. That kicked off a legal fight against the federal government, spearheaded by our next guest in a case known as Coleman versus Block. We're talking about the story behind that case and what lessons it has for the challenges facing farmers today. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you remember about the 1980s farm crisis? Did you or maybe someone in your family lose the family farm during that time or come close to it? Do you see parallels between what family farms went through in the 80s, what they're seeing right now? you work in farming or agriculture, we'd love to hear from you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah Vogel is the former Commissioner of Agriculture in North Dakota. She was the first woman in U.S. history elected to that position in any state. She tells the story of her legal fight in her new book, The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine, and the Fight to Save the Family Farm. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you. It's a treat to be here.
And I wanted to set the stage, first of all, farmers facing tough times, family farmers in North Dakota for a variety of reasons. Then there's this change of administration and a policy from the federal government in the early years of the Reagan administration when it came to farm loans through the Farmers Home Administration. What was the big change that really set the stage for your court case?
It was the appointment of David Stockman as the Director of Office of Management and Budget. He believed that the government had no business lending to farmers or to other small businesses, and he set up really severe delinquency reduction quotas for reducing the debt. And that those instructions went from him to Secretary Block to Charles Schumann, who ran the Farmers Home Administration. And the net result was basically a quota where every state had to achieve roughly 25% reduction in delinquent loans in a matter of months over the winter of 1982. And it set off a tsunami of foreclosures all across the country. And I was a lawyer, just returned from a career in Washington, D.C. I was in North Dakota working with farmers, and I saw the real life impacts of that policy on many of my clients.
Yeah, we just heard the big picture there. Can you zoom in now? For the farmers who became your clients, what did this policy mean to them? What did it look like?
Oh, it was awful. They were going along, having tough times, which, happens periodically in agriculture. And all of a sudden, one day, they would write a check and it would bounce. Or they go to the bank to withdraw money and there'd be no money in the bank account. And that's because Farmers Home had seized the money from their bank account. From that point forward, no money would be released to them for any purpose. If they sold a crop, all the money went to Farmers Home. Nothing went for the farmer. Nothing went to, pay their bills to Main Street. It all went back to Farmers Home in this attempt to reduce their delinquency. And in the result, they were starving the farmers off the farms. They were told, you have one choice. It's to quit farming voluntarily or we'll foreclose on you. Those were the only two choices farmers were being given. And it was happening to many, many thousands of farmers all over the country. It was really brutal.
A farmer in that position, of course, can't go out and hire a high-priced attorney. How did you end up being their last resort in a lot of ways?
Well, I'd been sort of programmed from birth. My family belonged to the Nonpartisan League, which was a political party pretty unique to North Dakota, but it did spread out in the early teens to a number of states, including Wisconsin. In Minnesota and even Canada. And the Nonpartisan League believed that government should be very supportive of farmers and the power of government belonged to the voters. So, and their main premise in the Nonpartisan League was that the duty of government to support family farmers, they were the lifeblood of North Dakota. So I grew up in this political party, and part of the legend, because it was history, it was true, is that the Nonpartisan League did a lot for the farmers in the 1930s. The governor of North Dakota, Governor Langer, declared a moratorium on all farm foreclosures. National leaders in the U.S. Congress were Nonpartisan Leaguers, and they helped get laws passed that helped farmers. So when this cataclysm hit, and I had just returned to North Dakota from working on the East Coast for about 10 years, I felt like I had no option. I had to help these farmers. I just had to. And I didn't realize at the time how incredibly difficult it would be, because by definition, every single one of my clients had not one penny to pay me. So they were bringing me fish that they caught and vegetables from the garden, and they would take gas from their on-farm storage and, give me $5 or $10, or sometimes they would borrow money from relatives and use it to pay me. But it was pretty tough. I mean, I was as poor as they were, but we worked together and we were pretty passionate about what we were doing.
We're talking to Sarah Vogel. Her new book is The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine and the Fight to Save the Family Farm, about a pivotal case in the 1980s with farm foreclosures coming from the federal government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience to share, maybe from that era or of the challenges facing your family farm, maybe right now, 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go to your calls now. Bill is with us in Sun Prairie. Bill, hello.
Yes, this is Bill in Sun Prairie. Wanted to tell the story about our family farm. My dad died in 1984 from, emphysema. And my mother was left with the farm. Two of my brothers were trying to make a go of it. Because of low prices, they had to file bankruptcy. Well, the Farmers Home Administration was in the process of foreclosing. Well, later on in the later 80s, Farmers Home Administration come out with a program where they would buy down their debt. In other words, you could pay off up to 50% of the debt, and the debt would be considered paid off. Well, I was able to negotiate a bank loan for my mother and sign the farm up into the CRP program. That was paying the debt, or paying off the bank each year. My mother then sold 240s, mostly wooded areas, which most farmers weren't interested in at that time, and paid off that debt. She was able then to live off of that income from that farm for close to 20 years before she passed away. And we just sold the last 110 acres about 3 years ago, and it was paid off last year. And the family got roughly $37,000. A family of 11 got roughly $37,000 each out of that farm remaining,
Bill, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Sarah, what that makes me think is, he said if those options came along later in the 80s. For your clients, they were not being presented with really any options, right?
That's right. What the caller just talked about came as a result of the 1987 Ag Credit Act, and that was that saved many farmers. It was these were desperate times, and eventually Congress came to the rescue with quite a few debt restructuring options that saved a lot of farmers. But when I filed the case, none of that was on the horizon yet.
Bill, thanks again for sharing that story. We're talking to Sarah Vogel about her new book, The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine and the Fight to Save the Family Farm. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story about your own family's farm back in the 80s or today, the challenges, maybe the legal challenges facing you or financial, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Sarah Vogel about her new book, The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine and the Fight to Save the Family Farm. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe if you have a personal story or a family story to share of the challenges facing farmers, your own family maybe, in the 1980s or beyond, 800-642-1234 is the number. Sarah, let's pick things up back the case now. You're the lawyer here, not getting paid a lot for these farmers who don't have anything to spend. What kind of things did you discover when it came to how these, especially these local county agents or supervisors, were dealing with these farmers?
Well, they tended to be, you know, it was a bureaucracy, and they tended to follow orders from on high. So Stockman ordered Block, and he ordered Truman to do the different things. It went down to the state office, and then it went to the county offices. And, you know, so the initiative to do these dreadful things to farmers did not come from the grassroots people. It came from on top, but they felt they had to follow orders. In subsequent years, I've learned that many people quit working at Farmers Home because they couldn't bear doing that. But that's how it came about. It came from Washington, D.C. It did not come from the countryside.
Let's go back to our callers now. Greg is with us in Jefferson. Greg, hi.
Hi. Thanks, sir. I have a question. Do you think there was anything in the mid-70s, early 70s that sort of led decisions maybe out of the USDA or out of Washington that sort of led farmers to overextend? My family's farm shrunk from about 900 acres to 200 in the early 80s. And it was just like your thoughts about that.
Greg, thanks for the call. We also heard via email from Jim in Cedarburg wondering about the impact of the Nixon and Earl Butts farm bill in working up to this. So can you set the stage for us a little bit in the 1970s before the change in the 80s that set the stage here?
Yeah, they were basically preaching from Washington, get big or get out. More and more and more people were supposed to get bigger, sell more. Land values were going up, up, up. They're, you know, really strong markets in Russia. And then all of a sudden things came to a crashing halt. And there was, you know, it was just devastating. So many people had borrowed money in good times, and then suddenly the rug was pulled out from under them. And it's kind of a lesson in overexpansion as well as overcontraction. So I was not worried so much with the overall economic themes. I just felt that these particular farmers, the ones I was working with, had been given a very, very bad deal. And there were laws that USDA was supposed to be following, and they were supposed to be following the Constitution. So, yeah, I mean, they could seek to foreclose on the farmer, but they had to follow the law. They had to follow the rules, and they weren't. So the lawsuit was saying there was a law called the 1980, it was a law passed in the Carter era that gave farmers the right to apply for deferral when they were temporarily unable to pay due to circumstances beyond their control. And USDA was not implementing that law. Moreover, they were not following the Constitution. They were not providing due process to those farmers and taking away their property. So the lawsuit that I brought with the help of the nine farmers, who were the North Dakota Nine, they were the lead plaintiffs. Eventually, it moved from nine lead plaintiffs to over 240,000 farmers nationwide and stopped many tens of thousands of farm foreclosures across the country. But, you know, very difficult times.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. This is a long uphill process. What ultimately happened in this case? What was the ruling that, as you said, ultimately prevented many foreclosures?
We had a wonderful judge, Judge Bruce M. Van Sickle, who had grown up in the 30s. He was a Republican. He was a compassionate and fair person. And he listened to our arguments and he heard us. And he said that, yes, the federal government has to follow the law. The federal government has to follow the Constitution. And he gave us a preliminary injunction stopping USDA from foreclosure until they provided farmers with a chance to apply for deferral and required them to follow the Constitution if they wanted to collect against the farmer. And that injunction was first in North Dakota, and then over the summer of 1983, there were so many calls from all over the country that eventually we, because by then I had other lawyers helping me too, by then, we expanded it into a national class action. And so it expanded to cover all farmers nationwide that borrowed from Farmers Home Administration. And at the end of the day, I think there were 16,000 farm cases already in court or heading to court. And so Judge Van Sickle's settlement, his injunction, protected all those farmers from further actions by USDA. So USDA had to send all those foreclosure cases back to the countryside, reopen the loan processing process. And then Congress in 1987 stepped in and set into place actual debt settlement procedures and, you know, really help farmers dig their way out of the morass that so many were in. The farmers, I want to emphasize that the farmers were producing as much and very well. I mean, it was not that they were inefficient or improvident. They were the best farmers, and they tended to be younger too, because older farmers had less debt. Younger farmers had gone to Farmers Home and borrowed. So it was a whole generation of farmers that were threatened by these actions of the federal government in the early 80s. It was pretty darn dramatic.
We're talking to Sarah Vogel, author of the new book, The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine and the Fight to Save the Family Farm. Sarah, most of your book is looking at this this case in the 80s. You also have your eye, though, on the modern day. We hear here in Wisconsin, bigger farms doing okay, a lot of new smaller farms doing all right. The medium-sized family farm, a worry here and a worry for you. Why is that?
Well, it's, you know, the very smallest of farms can often find off-farm employment to support the farm family. And the very largest firms, you know, they borrow from big banks or Wall Street, or, you know, they make it, the very biggest. But it's the ones in the middle, the middle-sized family farms, the backbone of America, the ones that the founding fathers believed democracy could not survive without. Those are the ones in trouble. And I wrote the book because I want to waken people up to the importance of family farmers to our democracy, to our society, to our survival. And I think COVID has certainly demonstrated that, you know, when there are shortages of food and, you know, you don't want to wait for products to be shipped in from Japan or China or Europe. You know, it's better if it's grown nearby. And so we're at a crisis point. And I think there are many, many good things that are going on now, and we all need to support them. In the end of the book, I recommend that people go to, say, the Farm Aid website and look at all the local organizations that are working to save family farms. The National Farmers Union, the Wisconsin Farmers Union, those are also great organizations. There's an entity called the Farmers Legal Action Group that was founded as a part of the 1980s farm crisis. And they're there to help lawyers. You know, if farmers need legal help, there are legal resources that they could use. And I really wrote the book maybe to provide hope to people that in prior very, very tough times, many people did make it through. Many people did survive. Many people were given hope by actions of Congress or what I did in court or what other lawyers did and other farmers and farm organizations. So there's always hope, and people should reach out. And I know today, you know, there are suicide hotlines and, you know, sources. There are places for people to reach out. And I hope that people who are in distress do reach out for help, because there may be very well help. It's very uneven too. I want to emphasize that, like, dairy farmers, I think, are particularly distressed. Beginning farmers are particularly distressed. So it varies by region. So you shouldn't look at just national statistics. You need to look at the people and how they are.
And that's a good place to leave it, Sarah. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's wonderful talking to you, Rob. Thank you so much.
You too. That's Sarah Vogel, the author of The Farmer's Lawyer, The North Dakota Nine, and The Fight to Save the Family Farm. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, many members of Congress have investments in stocks and other financial assets that raise concerns about conflicts of interest. A new report digs into the potential conflicts facing current members of the House and Senate. We'll find out what they found out. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, the CEO of the Anti-Defamation League says we can all work to shut down hate in America and prevent some of the social breakdowns that hatred can lead to. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.